Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 28. Today I have an interview with Dr. Peter Van Inwagen on the problem of evil. His writing has been quite influential in my thoughts on the topic, so I hope you enjoy. Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Van Inwagen.
I'm glad to be here.
So, can you tell me a bit about yourself, who you are and your background?
Well, I was born in 1942 in the northeastern U.S. I was raised a Unitarian, but lost interest in Unitarianism and religion in general when I was at the university. I began studying mathematics there, but found it too difficult for me, or at least I wasn't willing to do the work, so I switched to philosophy. I eventually became a teacher of philosophy. I taught for many years at Syracuse University in New York State. Now I teach at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. When I was about 40 years old, I became a Christian and have been one ever since. In philosophy, my specialty is metaphysics.
All right, then. So you're joining us for a discussion of the problem of evil today. Could you tell me what is the problem of evil and why is it a problem?
All right. To begin with, the word evil, as it occurs in the problem of evil, just means bad things. Doesn't mean anything more grand than that. Obviously, the world is full of very bad things and some things that are pretty bad, but not bad as the Holocaust or the Atlantic slave trade, say, you know, things like diseases and broken ankles. The problem of evil is the problem why there should be bad things in a world that was created by a God who's supposed to be both omnipotent and to love all the human beings that he's made with a perfect love.
Okay. Now, there's something called the logical problem of evil and the evidential problem of evil. What's the difference between those?
People used to think, and by used to, I mean, say, in the 1950s, a lot of people used to think that the existence of an all-powerful, loving God was simply logically inconsistent with the existence of any bad things at all. And they thought they could prove this, and they offered arguments for that conclusion. Many philosophers who were theists, like Alvin Plantinga, my colleague, Alvin Plantinga, for example, attempted to meet that. And it was generally conceded, even by atheists, that they succeeded pretty well in meeting that argument, that you couldn't really demonstrate that the existence of God was logically inconsistent with the existence of bad things in the world, but it was still felt that the existence of bad things in the world provided very strong, perhaps even irrefutable, evidence against the existence of God. So the logical problem of evil is held by most people to have been solved, but the evidential problem of evil, the problem of meeting this charge, that the existence of God is refuted by the evidence bad things in the world, that problem is held to be, is by no means held to have been solved, and many think it's in fact insoluble.
Okay. Now, I suppose the obvious thing that occurs to me, at least, is how on earth does someone measure the amount of evil in the world? If some evil's compatible with the existence of God, how do you work out the level, as it were?
Well, we can imagine the world, can't we, in which things are go much better than they do in this world, you know, in which the sort of world that many people hope for in the future, when science has advanced to the point where we have more control over nature and perhaps more control over our own destructive urges, so everybody lives together in peace and there's very little disease and physical pain. It's held the world is so much worse than it might be, even if we can't quantify it. You know, no, of course we can't give a, we can't measure something. There's no numerical measure of evil, but we can say that things could have been far better than they are. And many people have argued for the conclusion that if the world were governed providentially by a loving and all-powerful God, surely the world would be a much better place than it is.
Okay. It sounds like they want to second-guess an omniscient God who they concede can allow some evil, but that seems strange to me. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I see their point. That is, although I've spent a lot of time trying to show what the best sort of answer that a theist can give to the problem of evil is, I'm willing to grant that God would certainly want the world to contain a lot less evil, that is, bad things, than it does, would want human life to be nicer than it is. And I would, as I see the problem of why the world isn't the way God wants it to be. So I'm not sure about second-guessing. I mean, of course, one could say that God moves in mysterious ways and that we just don't know why there is all this evil. And in a way, that's position. Well, that is certainly a position that some people have taken, but I don't think that's the most useful way for someone who's trying to meet the argument to proceed. I suppose the question, one question is, what's one, if someone offers the argument from evil, let's say the argument from evil, to distinguish that from the problem of evil, is an argument for the non-existence of God. The argument that since there's this much evil in the world, there therefore is no God. If someone wants to meet that argument, one could say, you know, we just don't understand the mind of an omniscient being. But I think that one can do more than that. That is, one can try to tell plausible stories about why there should be this much evil in the world, even though an omnipotent and all and loving being didn't want there to be this much evil in the world.
Okay. What would be one of the explanations, or how would you go about dealing with the problem in that case?
Well, there are, of course, two ways that you might deal with it. One is that you might, if you thought you knew why there was so much evil in the world, if you actually thought that you knew what God's purposes were in saying that there was so much, in allowing the existence of so much evil, that you would tell people what God's purposes were. But then, of course, you would have to claim knowledge of the mind of God to be able to do that, and that's certainly a position that I don't regard myself in, and I don't think any other philosopher, as opposed to a theologian or even a prophet, has approached the problem, regards himself or herself in a position to know things like that. But what one can do that's different from that is to take the role of the defense counsel in a court of law and try to tell what might be some true stories, some stories that might be true, for all anyone knows about why this is the case. Philosophers discussing the problem of evil distinguish between a theodicy and a defense. A theodicy is a story about the evils in the world that's put forward as true. A defense is a story that's put forward as true for all anyone knows.
Okay, I see the difference there. So, how would you construct one of these? Theodicy was for anyone knows, wasn't it?
A defense, yes. Well, the most popular sort of defense, and the one I favor, and this has a has a history that goes back to Saint Augustine. Although Augustine presented this sort of story as a theodicy, not as a defense, you can see it in Milton's Paradise Lost as well, which is essentially a poetical version of Augustine. Is called the free will defense. If you put it forward as a defense, you're only telling how things might be. So suppose it's like this, the story. So the real problem that faces anybody who tries to answer the argument from evil is that an omnipotent being can do, as the term implies, anything. Well, anything? That is, could an omnipotent being, for example, draw a round square? Or could he make it both to rain and not to rain at the same place at the same time? most people who have considered that question say, well, no, even an omnipotent being can't do that which is logically contradictory. The concept of free will exploits that idea. That is, the idea that an omnipotent being can't do what's logically contradictory. Suppose free will is a good thing. Suppose it's good enough to warrant a certain amount of evil. But if God creates beings with free will, then those beings, well, even an omnipotent being can't ensure that they will exercise their free will one way or other than the other. That would be contradictory. That is, to determine the way that a person would exercise his or her free will. The will just wouldn't be free if the being determined it. So at least that gives a foothold that allows the entry of some evil into the world. And this indeed is exactly why people now generally regard what you call the logical problem as a problem that has a solution. At any rate, they say, yes, all right, an omnipotent being can't prevent a certain amount of evil if he allows the existence of free will, and perhaps free will is this great good that's worth a certain amount of evil. The problem then becomes to explain why God would allow so much evil in the world.
All right, so if free will can deal with some of the evil in the world, there's this distinction made between natural and moral evil. And I suspect when a lot of people think of evil, this is the evil they find the most bizarre and insoluble in terms of, you know, landslides and volcanoes and things.
So I think that's, if everybody was logical or rational, that would probably be the case. I think as a matter of fact, people find things like the Holocaust even greater problem than they find natural evil, though probably the natural evil on a philosophical level is harder to account for.
Okay, so how do you account for it? If you've got it, if it's, well, I agree with you, I think it's harder to account for, so how do you deal with something like natural evil?
Well, we should first note, and remember, we're just telling a story here. The idea is, can we tell a story that's true for all we know, in which there's natural evil? That is, evil that's not caused by the actions of human beings. Well, we should first note that maybe we don't have to say that the evil that results from earthquakes, for example, is not caused by the actions of human beings. Certainly earthquakes aren't caused by the actions of human beings, but it's not the earthquakes themselves that are evil. After all, if the only earthquakes occurred in uninhabited regions, when no one was around and they didn't cause any pain and suffering, they wouldn't be evil. They'd just be redistributions of the stresses in the Earth's crust.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose that we build into our story, and here I follow Augustine again, the biblical idea that there was a time when people lived in union with God, and that they, our earliest ancestors, and that by a perverse act of free will, they separated themselves from God. It may be that when people separated themselves from God, they lost all sorts of abilities that they had. Perhaps they were able to know when earthquakes would occur, or a tsunami, and were able to protect themselves from them simply by getting out of the way. Perhaps earthquakes themselves are inevitable. That is, that if the world holds together according to the laws of physics, then unless God wants to work huge, inexplicable miracles throughout nature, there are going to be earthquakes. Probably a better way to deal with the redistribution of stresses in the Earth's crust is to enable people not to be there when they happen. Perhaps people lost the ability to avoid earthquakes when they separated themselves from God by an act of free will. If so, then that act of free will would be the root cause of the pain and suffering caused by earthquakes. Similarly, they might have had the ability to cure diseases, the touch, to tame animals with a look. Perhaps all the suffering that's due to a perverse act of can be assigned to the original acts of free will by human beings.
Oh, okay. I see how that works. Now, is that all there is to dealing with human suffering like that? I remember reading in your paper that you had some on the magnitude and problem of evil and defense, that you had some other thoughts on how to go about dealing with the problem?
Well, I think there's certainly more, a lot more to the problem than that. I like to imagine the argument from evil being presented this way, that you have a debate in front of an audience of agnostics. And by agnostics, I mean true agnostics. That is, not people who are strongly inclined to believe that there is no God, but aren't quite willing to say there is no God. But people who really are sitting on the fence between there being a God and there not being a God. And you can imagine an atheist and a theist standing before them, trying to push them one way or the other. And when it's the theist, for example, might offer arguments for the existence of God. But when it's the atheist's turn, the atheist will offer arguments against the existence of God, and presumably the argument from evil will be among them. Now, if the atheist had offered this argument and the theist had presented the defense I just presented, there would be a lot more that the atheist could have to say to these agnostics in the audience. For example, the atheist could bring up the question, but why didn't God just immediately reverse the effects of this, let people start over, as it were? Or why doesn't God simply work an endless series of miracles to take up the slack that's left by the loss of these abilities and protect us from the effects of our separating ourselves from God? The debate would have to go on for quite a while and touch on a great many points. You know, what I've mentioned is just sort of the very beginnings of a debate about this story called the free will defense, in the version in which it assigns natural evil to some sort of primordial separation of human beings from God by an act of free will.
Okay. So how would you deal with some of those objections?
Well, we would have to ask, for example, what God's purpose was in creating human beings. And what I essentially would do would be to build into the story a lot of what is in fact Christian theology, though I don't put it forward as theology, but just as a possible story. If you imagine the theist putting these things forward, what the theist would be, the reaction that the theist would be hoping for from all the agnostics in the audience is, gee, for all we know, that might be true. That is, if there is a God, all the rest of that theological stuff might be true as well. I would begin by saying that God's purpose in creating the human beings was to bring them into union with himself, to be in a kind of loving union with him, and that when they separated themselves from him, his purpose would be to reunite them to him. If he were simply, for example, to cancel the effects of their separating themselves from him, he would be putting them in a situation where they would have no motivation to try to return to him. In fact, according to Christian theology, they're unable to return to him. One of the effects of the fall is that they've ruined themselves to such an extent they're even unable to return to God by an act of free will. Having left God, having walked out of God's presence by an act of free will, they are no longer free to return to him. Returning to God would have to be a cooperative endeavor in which God enters the souls of people and tries to help them return to him. But if they don't have any motivation to do so, if the world is made into a reasonably pleasant place, they won't really see what the effects of separating themselves from God was. In the parable, if you think of the parable of the prodigal son, for example, it would be as if the father of the prodigal son had followed the son to whatever flesh pots the son had gone off to and secretly slipped him money and hired bodyguards to keep him from being beat up and have his money stolen and so on. That might make the son's life in the flesh pots a little more pleasant, but that's not really the father's objective. The father's objective is to have the son turn around and return to him.
Oh, okay. So if you want to walk away from God and live your own life, God says okay and lets you bear the consequences so that you learn properly what's going on, or you understand the consequences of your action.
If you don't, you know, I would, first of all, I'd be a deceiver. I'd be deceiving you into thinking that you can live successfully on your own. and I'm not a deceiver. You have to understand what it's like simply because that's the truth. But moreover, the truth shall set you free, or at least it will be, it contains the only hope of your ever being free. You have to have some motivation. You have to see that the way that you're living is unsatisfactory, and to accept the offer which is given of a way back to God. And you can, of course, build into the story that God has put into the world various information through revelation about a way back to himself. So the story becomes rather complicated. It becomes, in fact, almost Christian theology, though I haven't said anything, in fact, about the nature of the way back to God according to Christians. What I've said so far, I think, would be acceptable to Jews and Muslims as well. That is, that God has some plan for us in the situation that we've got ourselves into, and that if we don't cooperate with him to get ourselves out of this, we're not going to get out of it. And to make things pleasant as possible for us here is really going to frustrate his long-term plans for us.
Okay, I think that's a really good answer. I'll be interested to see what listeners to the show make of that. Okay, so...
But it is a very sketchy answer. That is, there's a lot more to say about this. What I've said is mostly hints about how an answer might be developed. Sometimes people think that the argument from evil is such an obviously unanswerable argument that they're very impatient with any answer that has more than a few sentences. The argument from evil can, after all, be presented in a few sentences. If someone goes on and on, as I have, and even yet hasn't said anything really satisfactory. And I don't think I've said anything really satisfactory. I've just given hints of the direction in which I'm going. They've become impatient. But I do think that a proper answer is rather complicated.
Fair enough. So, just to wrap up now, if people wanted to learn more, where would be a good place to investigate this problem further?
Well, the sorts of things I've been saying are developed in my book, The Problem of Evil. There are two excellent collections of readings by philosophers on this. And remember, I'm telling you mostly what philosophers have said, as opposed to theologians or spiritual writers. And so on, my mind is irredeemably philosophical. And this is the kind of thing I get something out of. It doesn't help everyone. But I'm considering this problem as the problem of what to say about a certain argument for the non-existence of God. That's very far from the whole of what the problem of evil is. In fact, the problem of evil is many different things. The words mean many different things to different people. So I would say that my topic was really the force of a certain philosophical argument for the non-existence of God. Besides my book, which I'd mentioned, I would mention a collection of readings called The Problem of Evil, edited by Marilyn and Robert Adams. And there's another book called The Problem of Evil, Selected Readings, edited by Michael L. Peterson. Those books contain a lot of very valuable essays on the topic.
Okay. I'll put links to those in the show notes. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Van Inwagen.
And thank you for including me in your program. I'll be interested to hear anything that you can tell me about what the listeners have said.
I'll let you know. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Van Inwagen, and come over to the Sci-Fi Show forums and we can discuss it further. Talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.